originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Sabre wins the Derby for Todd Fletcher.
Basalt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone. I'm Mike Penna. Welcome to the show trainers listen to. This is Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Happy to have you with us right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network, broadcasting from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios and extending a very special welcome to everyone joining us throughout North America on Sirius 219 XM Channel 206. And those of you tuning in on our website on your smartphone or your tablet, whatever it might be, you're doing that at horseracingradio.net. Well, flying solo for you tonight as the Pontiff is enjoying a little R&R, but it is going to be one heck of an hour. And our guest tonight is the reason for this very special show. Tonight's guest, believe it or not, has been on Horse Racing Radio Network on many different occasions, but he's only been on Trainer Talk one time. That was for a 30-minute visit back on November 21st of 2012. It was the first year that we launched Trainer Talk, and we got a chance to talk to him about getting started in this business and some of the things that he had accomplished to that point. Well, since that date in 2012, tonight's guest has accomplished a few other things. How about this? He has saddled nearly 1,000 additional winners, which includes 4 Breeders' Cup winners, a Queen's Plate winner, a Preakness runner-up, an Eclipse Champion Juvenile Colt, a 2-time Champion Grassmare, a Male Turf Champion, and 2 Canadian Horses of the Year, including a filly that would be named the Sovereign Award Champion 2-year-old filly. She would also be named the Champion Grassmare and the Horse of the Year all in the same season. And if that's not enough, tonight's guest was also inducted into the Canadian Horse Racing Hall of Fame in 2016 and was among the finalists for the American Horse Racing Hall of Fame this past year. Yeah, he is trainer Mark Cassie, and he joins us right now for the full hour here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Mark, what's new?
I'm tired, Mike, after hearing about all that.
You've been a busy man these last 6 years or so.
Yeah, well, thank you. It's been quite a ride.
You know, I visited with your son Norm on this program a couple of weeks ago, and I mentioned that Norm had a lot of things happen since the last time we had the chance to catch up with him on Trainer Talk, and that was only a 3-year span. And I don't know if we've ever had anybody that has had so many changes happen both personally and professionally than your son Norman. But I'll tell you what, on the professional side, my friend, you've had it rolling.
Oh, thank you. And a lot of it has to do with, you know, with him. He's been a huge part of our success with our team. And, you know, we're very fortunate. We have a lot of wonderful owners and a lot of good horses.
I know he's still spending a little time helping you, but he also saddled his first starter last Wednesday, a horse by the name of Raider Return, who finished second. And that had to be a pretty proud moment for you.
Oh, it was. It brought tears to my eyes. I don't know. I know he was a nervous wreck. I know I was. And I guarantee you, I was screaming as hard as anybody, you know, for him to win. And, you know, he's just thinking back over the years and how far he's come. And I know where he's going. So, very, very, very proud pop.
Did you encourage him to go out on his own, or did he come to you and say, Dad, it's time?
No, I think he probably came to me. I sure wouldn't think that I discouraged him. You know, I think he, in the end, he brought a good point, and that is, he knows one thing about horse trainers. They don't usually retire. They usually die. And he said, you're going to be doing this for a long time. And so there's never going to be a good time for me to do this. So he just needs to do it. And I sure haven't discouraged him from doing it. And I understand why he's doing it. Am I going to miss him? Of course.
Yeah, and I would imagine you would, especially having him by your side for so long. Mark, what do you think the most important lesson that you've been able to teach Norm over the years that's going to help him now that he goes out on his own? What's that most important lesson, Ben?
That's a good one. I don't know. I think what I learned from my dad and always treat people the way you want to be treated. And I think so many times, I think our owners are mistreated, and it's a privilege. It's a privilege to train for these people and understand that these horses, a lot of times it's like they're children. And so you got to remember that. And ultimately they make the final decision. It's theirs. They make the final decision. So, I've said that many times. I don't know that sometimes he doesn't understand my decision-making, maybe, but it's a lot of times it's based on that.
What's the biggest lesson that he's going to have to learn on his own?
Well, I would say probably one thing that, all the responsibility falls on my shoulders normally. So when there's bad news to be given out, I'm the one that gives it. And he hasn't had to do a lot of that. His only bad news has had to come to me. And when you have to give it to somebody outside, it's a little more difficult.
Yeah, it's never easy when you have to approach somebody and give them news that's not positive. And certainly that'll be one thing that every trainer, I think, as a young trainer, has to go through. And Mark, I'm sure you had to go through that same process, right?
Oh, I have. And, it becomes, it's something pretty well I do every day now. So it's it takes some doing and getting used to. And I've always found I'd rather just get it over with than sit on it. I want to get it off my chest.
Mark Cassie, our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. He will be with us for the full hour here tonight. And just getting started, if you're just joining us, should be a really enjoyable visit. Mark, thinking back to that visit in 2012, you spent a lot of time talking about working around your dad's operation, learning from your father, and then going out on your own. And then you talked a little bit about taking a bit of a break from the training side for several years and working on the farm. Take people through a little recap of how you got started in the business, because they may not remember that.
Well, my dad got into the horse business when I was about five. So I've kind of grown up with horse racing. When I was 15, I was running the training barn. I'd get off school early in the afternoon, and we would train in the afternoon. I actually galloped horses. For a short time, I wanted to be a rider, but I could never be a jockey, but I couldn't keep my weight down. I was at 18. At 17, I got my trainer's license at the Great Barrington Fair in Massachusetts. And the reason I did that was Massachusetts at the time was the only state that you could get a trainer's license at 17.
I didn't know you were a Great Barrington Fair graduate.
Oh, are you kidding? I run the first three horses I ran there.
Wow. So, okay, I don't know if you realize this, but I grew up in Pittsfield.
I didn't.
I'm extremely familiar with Great Barrington and the entire fair circuit in Massachusetts.
Marshfield Fair, the Great Barrington Fair.
Northampton?
Northampton. We used to, I would go with my dad. My dad had a big horse van, a six-horse van, and it had a peak up in it, and that's where we'd sleep at night.
What are some of the favorite memories that you have about the Great Barrington Fair and that running horses on that fair circuit? Maybe some of the stories you still like to tell.
Oh, it's crazy. If anybody you go around and you can't see them because they, you know, they're around the turn in the popcorn or the corn dog tent is up. You know, it was just, I don't know. I didn't understand it like I understood it now, but it, I don't know. Probably the thing that was the most enjoyable was spending the time with my dad, you know, and I've just always, Mike, I've always loved horse racing. When I, you know, when I was 12 years old, the worst day of the week was Sunday because there was no racing for it. I could tell you, I mean, that's all I did. I would read the racing form to front, to, you know, front to back and back to front. And so I just loved horse racing. I've always loved horse racing. So, and then when I was 18, the deal was with my dad that I was going to run horses at Keeneland and Churchill in the summertime, Ellis Park or Arlington, and then go to college. But I had such a good first year. My dad said, are you going to go to college? I said, I'm not going to college. And, you know, off I went. And been doing it ever since. You talk about, you know, there was a period of time. I'd done so much so early that I was probably just a little bent out on, you know, being at the track. More than, it's not so much being at the track, it's the moving, the constant moving and moving. It's what took me to Woodbine ultimately. But I guess it would have been in the 80s. I got a chance to work for a guy named Harry Mangurian, mm-hmm. who still to this day I think is the smartest man I've ever been around. And so much, he saw the potential in me, and he gave me the ability to go out and do some of the things that I wanted to do. And I was his general manager of Mockingbird. And when I went to work for him, he was fourth or fifth leading breeder in North America. And I said to him, I said, Mr. Mangurian, if you let me do this, you let me do this, and you let me do this, you'll be the leader in North America. And his famous saying would be, so you say. And I said, so I say. And I'd say, so I will. And within about 4 years, we were the leading breeder in North America. But more importantly, a lot of people don't know this, because he was a very wealthy man, but he was also very frugal. And I think 4 years in a row, we started one sire, and he was the leading freshman sire. 4 years in a row, we had, like, the leading freshman sire. And wow. It was because I was able to control every part of the puzzle and the equation. And by doing it, we were able to kind of manipulate their performances. And by getting them in the right places, nobody else had a chance.
Were you always that confident growing up, Mark?
I was always pretty confident. I just never really think about failing. It's not an option. That doesn't mean I like to use baseball as a comparison. I often say this. It's not what it's when you're talking about success and failure, especially in our business. It's not how many runs you score each inning, it's how many you score at the end of the game. So sometimes, yeah, you have some rough innings. You don't score any runs. You may get hit by a pitch. You may strike out. But if you continue to be positive, keep trying, in the end, you're going to score more runs than your opponent. And that has always been my goal.
Well, you've scored plenty of runs in your career, a total of 2,421 victories to date for trainer Mark Cassie, who is our special guest here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Mark, one thing that you mentioned was all of the travel and moving and how that can get difficult. It was difficult on you at one point. How have you now managed that, and is it less difficult now?
It's actually less difficult now. There's so many, you know, things have changed so much since I started training. I've been doing it. I've been now a trainer, I think, 38 years. of course, of those 38 years, there was about 8 years when I ran the Mockingbird farm and the Mangarian that I just talked about that I didn't hardly train a horse. I was more, you know, concerned with the breeding part of the horse racing. But, you know, now with technology, we're able to see and do so many more things. And what I've done is we have a tremendous training center now in Ocala, and it's the core. It's our hub. All the horses come through our hub. It gives me, I spend a lot of time there, and that's where we get the horses ready. And then that's where, you know, after communicating with our various owners, decide where horses are going to go. It's the thing that makes us strong. I think many times horses are probably don't reach their full potential because they're placed in an area where the owner wants them to be or the trainer wants them to be, and it's not really what's best for the horse. The job that I try to do is figure out where the horse fits in the best. And Catch a Glimpse would be a good example of that. Catch a Glimpse showed potential. We took her to Saratoga. She was not handling the stress of Saratoga. And if we had continued, we ran her one time, and she ran just okay, but she just was not handling the environment there. And I said to Gary Barber and Jeff Begg, I said, if we continue down this path, this filly will be worthless. I said, let's send her to Woodbine where it's a little quieter. Let's let her settle, try to get some confidence and see what happens. I know she has ability. It's just we have to get her going in the right direction. Well, then we sent her to Woodbine. She settled a little bit. We ran her. She ran well, and she won. Then we ran her back, and, you know, she ran even better. She won the Natalma. And then she went on and won the Breeders' Cup. Had that filly been somewhere else, and I'm not for a minute going to sit here and tell you that I'm a better trainer than a lot of these guys. That is not what I think. I'm as good as anybody else. I don't think I'm better than anybody else. But the thing that makes, you know, we have a great team. And we have the ability to move horses. We have a little filly running this weekend down at the fairgrounds, Guy to Vegas. There's a filly that struggled, but we got her winning, and she's won 4 out of her last 5 starts. A lot of people don't realize, but, you know, when we got world approval, he had run a couple times and hadn't run any good when we first got him. And first thing I said to Norman is, we got to run this horse on the grass. And then you can see it's the thing that makes me probably some of our proudest moments would be, I don't know that world approval started out as a great horse, but he became one under our care. The same thing with Teppan. And I have to be honest with you, a lot of it was Norman, too, helping with the team. Getting, you know, he's been a great big part of that as well. But it takes everybody. The biggest team member of all that took our entire team was Classic Empire, because he threw lots of curveballs at us. And to get him to win the Arkansas Derby, it wasn't so hard as a 2-year-old, even though he did do his little number at the hopeful. It was what he did as a 3-year-old and what we had to do to get him to win the Arkansas Derby, and then even to make it to the Kentucky Derby and run second to the Preakness. It took a total team effort from everyone aboard.
What do you mean by throwing lots of curveballs at you, Mark?
Well, of course, he threw the curveball at us in the hopeful when he made the right-hand turn and lost the rider.
Yeah, that's a curveball.
And then, what's that?
I said, that's one hell of a curveball.
Yeah, that was a good curveball. So we got over that. And then, of course, you know, he got down to Palmettos, and his feet would give us problems. He wouldn't train. We ended up, I don't know if you remember the story, but we ended up bringing him back to his roots. We brought him back to where we started, brought him to our training center, put the rider on him, that had broke him and had been with him when he was young, and we started all over again. And we were able, you know, we won the Arkansas Derby off of, a 3-month layoff. Not many trainers have the facility to do what we did, and that was to bring them home to our place and get them ready. So we all started, you asked me the question about my travel. I don't do quite as much travel as I used to because I'm based in Ocala. I oversee, you know, everyday training in Ocala. And then as the horses get ready to run, they go to, you know, the different racetracks. I receive every morning, if the horses work, I usually see a video of the work. I also get a video of any horse that works or runs or breezes the day before. I'll get a video of them jogging the next day so we can keep it as a record and analyze it. So, we use a lot of the modern technology, which allows me to read all the information, collect all the information, and I don't necessarily have to fly all over. I do try to get to each division and look at the horses and talk to our assistants and see. And I place horses into assistants also that I think will get along with them better and not. And you know, there's some horses that can't take shipping. There's some horses, you know, Woodbine. You go to Woodbine, you can stay there for 9 months, and a horse can settle in and enjoy it there. Where, you know, if you're racing somewhere else, we have to move every month or two, and some horses can't take that. That's my job. That's what I do. I figure that out.
Yeah, almost like a manager in baseball, trying to make all the right moves with the players and put them in the best position to succeed. Is that a fair analogy?
That would be an absolute perfect analogy. And what I do is I'm the head coach. I have assistant coaches. I put those players in the hands of the coaches that I think can do the best job for them.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting too, Mark, because a lot of times when I talk to people that aren't as familiar with our game as we are, and they'll ask me about trainers like, say, yourself or Bob or Steve Asmussen or Todd, and trainers that have horses all over the country and have big strings, and they'll say, wait a minute, how does that one guy train all those horses? He can't, because they're in different parts of the country. And you just touched on the assistants, but it sounds to me like you are, even though you're not there putting your hands on those horses each and every morning, you are still hands-on, and you know what's going on with every single horse that's in every location around the country.
Well, that's, you know, it takes, that's what we try to be, and it's very time-consuming. I would say, you know, I start early in the morning, and I'll still be working on things till about 8 or 9 o'clock at night normally. And, you know, analyzing things, then looking at races, watching workouts. And there was recently a big article, and I don't want to get into it much because I'm not going to get into a big fight with anybody. I have too many things going on, but why our horses don't run as much as they used to. Bill Finley wrote an article recently in the TDN, and there have been a lot of things said, reasons why, but they're, for the most part, everybody's missing the boat, in my opinion. I sit and look at 4 and 5. I have the ability to run at 5, 6, 7 different racetracks in a given month or day. Mm-hmm. So I'm sitting looking and analyzing 5 and 6 condition books. And have the ability to move them. You know, I can find a race in New York this weekend and have a horse here in Ocala and send him to New York tomorrow.
Yep.
So we have that ability. So it allows me to look around. Some, you know, it's good for some people. Some people believe, of course, that we have too many horses and that they want, you know, somebody that's there every day looking. Interesting, when I first started with Mrs. Weber four or five years ago, 6 years ago, she said, well, where are you going to be? Because I want you to be with the horses. And I told her, and then 2 years down the road and the success we were having moving around, she said to me, are you going, you're going to be in California? And I said, I just left there. No, she said, I don't care whether you are going to be. Do you have a team in California? So she understands. Mr. Oxley understands. The guy, the other person that understands completely is Gary Barber. They know that I know what's going on. And the other thing is, when I say to them, they'll say, what do you think? I'll say, this horse is going to run good, or this horse may need a race, or this or that. We're right 90% of the time. Now, I don't ever predict victory. I just don't do that. There's too many variables. But to me, when I run a horse, all I ask is that he runs well and at some point was in a position to win. Whether he's good enough, you know, there's so many variables that can control the outcome that are out of my control. So I don't predict victories. I only predict whether a horse is going to run good. And I do that with knowing my people telling me what they're telling me by watching things, by watching videos, by, you know, we have a system. And I'll never be a 25% win percentage, 23. It's not the way we do things. I actually believe that by winning first time out, we often do it. And if it's, I actually think there's a lot of negatives to it. I think that there's not enough, horses don't get enough experience when they win their first start. They go, they break their maiden first time out. Next thing you know, they're going into a much tougher race, and they just don't have the experience. So, I have different beliefs. Norman believes different things. What I'm saying, Norman necessarily, you know, Joe Blow may not have the same beliefs, but it's what works for me. It works for us. A lot of times, like you said, people say, well, how do they see the horses? But that's not really, the proof is in the pudding. How you're successful, and to me, is the most important thing. And that's what I'm paid to do, is to be successful. If I'm not successful for somebody, then I get fired.
Yeah, yeah, he's trainer Mark Cassie. He's our special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Coming up to our break, we're going to step away for just a couple of minutes. We'll come back. Second half of the program, we'll talk more about some of the owners that Mark has been associated with and some of those relationships he's been fortunate enough to develop. And we'll talk about a couple of the big-name horses that he's been around in recent years, including the great Teppan. Stay with us as Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
The Fasig Tipton Gulfstream Sale. Join us Florida Derby Week at the nation's premier destination for selected two-year-olds in training. From Kentucky Derby winner Nyquist to recent stars like Dream Tree, More Spirit, Audible, and Mopetism, Gulfstream grads are hotter than ever. This year's sale boasts quality from top to bottom and an under-tax show held over Gulfstream's dirt racetrack. Selected sales, superior results. The Fasig Tipton Gulfstream Sale, March 28th. Where will you be?
Bloom Racing.
Majestic City could also still do it, and here he comes.
Majestic City running a big one.
Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Soul Driver the leader, though. Soul Driver in front.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at bloomracing.com.
It all started with a dream. A dream to be the best. To breed the best. To race the best.
Super Saver Rosso Maia, what a finish to the contest.
And to stand the best. Windstar Farm. Dedicated to the dream.
This is Trainer Talk on HRRN, presented by Fasig Tipton.
What do you think? 7 7 9 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 8 $200 $8,200,000 Here we go now. $8,000,000 in the back. $8,200,000 $8,200,000 on this great race mare. $8,209,000 Are you done? $8,200,000 In the back. $8,000,000 Woody, thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, we wish Mr. Batmaster some every success in the future as he goes in search of another great champion, a great sporting owner. Thank you, Mr. Masterson.
Oh, what a way to welcome you back to the second half of Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton. Mike Penn live in our Jimmy Johns of Lexington broadcast studios. Happy to have you back with us. Teppan, the outstanding dual champion race mare, trained by Mark Cassie, ending her career in the auction ring at Phasic Tipton here in Lexington, Kentucky, this past November, going under the gavel for a final price of $8 million. Just a spectacular way to go out on top, and she certainly deserved it, as spectacular as she was throughout her entire career. Don't forget, if you missed any portion of the show, you can head over to our website. That's horseracingradio.net. You can check out the podcast at your leisure. You can check out the podcast of this show and all of our programming right there, horseracingradio.net. Mark, I can imagine that moment, having Teppan sell and watching the numbers go up, had to be somewhat special, but it also had to be somewhat bittersweet.
Well, I don't know about bittersweet. I was very proud of her, very proud of our team and what we were able to do with it. And I was happy to see Coolmore by her. So I know she's in a great place, and she's got a, if she can be as successful as a broodmare, it'll be with them. They do a wonderful job. So I was excited to see Coolmore by her.
She provided racing fans in the industry with so many unbelievable memories when you look back on her career. What's your top Teppan moment, Mark?
Oh, that one's pretty easy. It had to be Royal Ascot. I mean, there's been a lot of, I mean, her Breeders' Cup win was great, but And now more than ever, I realize how tough it is to do what she did and to go over and win at Ascot and have the things against her that she had against her, and being able to overcome them. That was easily the best moment. You have to remember when we won the Breeders' Cup at Keeneland, they're playing her backyard. She went over and beat them in their backyard. That's not easy to do.
Yeah, a special moment for Teppan winning there at Royal Ascot. Mark, earlier in the interview, first half of the program, you mentioned that horses like Teppan and even World Approval didn't necessarily start out as great horses, but they became great as they moved throughout their career. Was there a moment, let's say with Teppan, for example, was there a moment when you kind of said, all right, she's turned the corner, she gets it, she's going to be tough from here on out?
You know, Teppan always showed that she had some talent. She showed it at two, struggled at three. And I have to say, Mr. Masterson has always been one, as Mrs. Weber, to give horses time. And when we brought her back, we ran her as a four-year-old. I think Julian rode her. It might have been the first time Julian ever rode her when she won down at Gulfstream. And the way she won, it was impressive. And after that, I thought, you know what, this filly's really something. And so that really got me. I knew she was good. I guess maybe I'm trying to think of the name of the race before she won the Breeders' Cup at Keeneland. I want to say it was the First Lady, but I'm not sure it is.
Yeah, it was.
When she won and won with the ease she did, I was like, I was just shaking my head because, to me, on that, there she went from good to great at that point in time.
When a trainer leads a horse over that's that good and that good consistently, what's the walkover like, Mark? Is it an anxious walkover or is it a confident walkover?
It's nerve-wracking. It's, you know, you're not wanting to let them down. It just depends on the situation. I wasn't that nervous for the Breeders' Cup. I felt like getting there was quite an accomplishment. I knew she was as ready as she was going to be, and no matter what happened, she was, you know, I was just happy to be there. I find it, though, the more they accomplish, the harder, you know, the more you don't want to let them down. I've often, I mean, I admire Bob Baffert about as much as anybody because of what he's done. I mean, it's one thing, like with American Pharoah, the pressure of getting through the Triple Crown. But after having the Triple Crown winner and being able to accomplish what was done after the Triple Crown, now that takes some nerve because you know, once you become the focus of everybody's attention, then the real pressure, you know, gets involved. But you can also look at it, I look at it this way too. It's, I'm just lucky and privileged to be doing something that I love, and you got to enjoy it as well. So, you know, are you ever totally confident? No, I've every time I get totally confident, I get knocked down. So I tend not to get too confident.
When Teppan came to that 2015 Breeders' Cup, she wasn't your only top horse that you were going to saddle. You also had Catch a Glimpse, I remember, and you stopped by one of our morning shows that we were doing prior to the races. And I remember talking to you about being on that huge Breeders' Cup losing streak. Let's put it like that. You were, what, 0 for 23 coming into that Breeders' Cup. All of a sudden, here comes Catch a Glimpse, here comes Teppan, and we're off and running. And now you've saddled multiple Breeders' Cup winners. Take me back to that moment when Catch a Glimpse crosses the finish line first.
Well, there was a lot of pressure taken off my shoulders when she won the Breeders' Cup. And the pressure was only put on my shoulders by myself. But I kind of felt like, look, when I was a little boy, I went to the, I went when I was like 12, I went with my dad to the Hall of Fame in Saratoga, and I looked at it and wondered if someday that I could be in there. That was kind of one of my dreams. And even though we had had, you know, as much success as we've had in Canada and a lot of places, I kind of felt like when she won the Breeders' Cup, maybe that would give me a little extra push at getting there. I guess that would probably, if you said to me when I started my career, what would you like to accomplish as a horse trainer, would be the Hall of Fame, because it says that you just weren't good on one day, you were good on many days. And so that was in my mind as well.
So what was it like to see your name as one of the finalists for the Hall of Fame this past year?
No, it was extremely special, and you know, just to make the ballot and to be mentioned with the greats, you know, it's a dream come true. So it was very, you know, I was very proud to get in the Hall of Fame in Canada. It means a lot to me. But again, as a small boy with my father, And I wonder, he passed away a few years ago, and I just wonder if he ever thought about maybe me making it there as well,
Yeah.
So maybe someday.
Well, you're heading in the right direction, my friend.
I hope so. A lot of people, I'm very proud. We just moved into eighth all-time ever in North America. I think we passed Shugan McGahee in the earnings. So,
wow.
We're trying.
Yeah. That year that you referred to in 2016 when your dad passed away, you and I had several conversations even over the past couple of years, and I know you referred to me as Barbara Walters because it always seemed like we would get emotional and you would start crying in an interview. But to stay focused the way you did, Mark, and to have the success that you had throughout 2016 and into last year, how difficult was it for you to stay focused?
With losing my dad?
Yeah.
I'm a focused person. My wife will tell you too, focused. I don't do many things, but whatever I do, I spend a lot of time on it. So now, even when Dad passed, I feel like he's still there, and I'm still striving to make him proud. Even though he's not there, I know he's watching. And I can remember as a young boy, one time I did something he told me he wasn't proud of me, and that hurt me more than anything in the world. And so I've kind of tried to live my life trying to make him proud. And though he's no longer on earth, I feel like he's there in heaven watching. So I never lost any focus. If anything, it made me want it that much more. One of my funniest moments with my dad a few months before he passed away, we had just won the Breeders' Cup. And I drove home, and of course, he lived right near me, and I stopped and I saw him, and I said, "What'd you think, Dad?" And he put his hands about a foot apart, and he said, "You were that far from winning three." So he didn't want to talk about the two Breeders' Cups we won. He wanted to talk about the one that we could have, but that was my dad. My dad always was, my driving force, right? So, I guess probably when I miss him most, a lot of times when I would travel on a Sunday evening, I'd drive home from the airport and I would call him on my drive and we would talk about the races, because later on in his life, he had some real issues with his back. So he was bedridden most of the time. And the one thing that I think kept him going was watching the races and watching us run horses. And so he would watch every race, of course, bet $20 on it or whatever. So we would analyze and go over every race. And I think one of the times it hit me the hardest was I was driving home and I couldn't call him. So I still have his number in my phone.
Yeah. Yep. Mark Cassie with us here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mark, earlier you referred to the pressure that you put on yourself coming into the Breeders' Cup there in 2016. And you talked about all the pressure going into Keeneland and, being on that losing streak. Is it somewhat the same now when you look at the Triple Crown races? Do you put a lot of pressure on yourself now to win a Triple Crown race?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, I would say, if you told me if there were two things left in my career that I would like to accomplish, one would be to the Hall of Fame. The second would probably be to win the Kentucky Derby. So I don't put a lot of pressure on myself. Interesting enough, I was really good all the way up. Given, like I said, Classic Empire threw some curveballs at us. And I can remember driving home the morning of the Kentucky Derby that morning. And I was fine all the way until then. And it was like, whew, we're actually going to make it. You know, I'd looked at him that morning. He was fine. It was really going to happen. We were going to, and I thought we had an extremely good shot to win the Kentucky Derby. I did. And I actually got emotional then driving home. I was like, oh, you know, because he had tested us, like I said. And unfortunate, I don't know. No one will ever know. He got very unlucky, or it would have been an interesting Kentucky Derby with him in Ollie Streamy. And, but anyways, and I thought I took it all well. You know, when you have a dream your entire life, it's all you want to do, and it kind of gets smashed in the first 100 yards.
Yeah.
You know, I thought I handled it fine. So,
yeah, anyways. You know, you always, you know, like you said, you always want to win a race like the Kentucky Derby, and then you come there with a horse that's among the favorites, didn't go off as the favorite, Always Dreaming did, but he was the morning line favorite. And to have him not get off to the best of beginnings and to have a rough trip and things not go his way, I always wondered if it's more difficult on a trainer to lose that way or to have your horse get a perfectly clean trip, maybe come running at the end and come up just a little bit short. What's more difficult?
Oh, I can tell you by far, there's nothing more difficult and frustrating for a horse trainer than to have a horse, have everything go right, get it to work, and then just never have a shot. You know, I often say that with riders. You know, the only thing you could ask a rider to do is put you in a position to win. And as long as they do that, whatever the outcome is, I think it's easier to accept. Where it gets a little, I took the Preakness loss pretty good. I mean, we looked like we were going to win the Preakness, and we got beat it right at the wire. I was fine with all that. We had went in with a strategy, and I, you know, a lot of people wanted to say, well, Julian moved too soon, this and that. And that was all baloney. We had a strategy, and the strategy was we felt like we had the best horse, and the horse to beat was Always Dreaming. And we decided we were going to go at him, and we were going to let the best horse win. The problem was, you know, Always Dreaming had a bad day, and he kind of surrendered the lead a lot quicker than we had anticipated. And when that happened, Classic Empire, you know, made the lead, and as he often does, would start loafing.
Yep.
And he actually tried to come back and still win the race, but it was just a little too late. And plus, you know, he paid the price for putting Always Dreaming away as well. So, but I was fine with it all. I thought, hey, we did our plan. We did it. It didn't work. That's okay. It's when you put in a plan in place and it never materializes or gets a chance. That's very frustrating.
You know, Julian Leperu is somebody who has been on a lot of your top horses the past several years. You developed a relationship with him, and he seems to fit your program and your horses for whatever reason. Julian was flying back on the same flight as us after that Preakness, and he was a little bit upset with himself. He felt like maybe he did cost Classic Empire that race, and I kind of told him the same thing that you did. I said, Julian, I don't think you did. I think you did everything you could possibly do, and the horse came up just a little bit short. He, you know, you said earlier, Mark, that losing is not an option, and I think Julian feels that same way. Is that why he's such a good fit for your program?
I mean, Julian's a good fit for our program for so many reasons. And by the way, I knew that he was taking it very hard, and I called him personally and said, Julian, this was not about you. You did the right thing, and, you know, you hold your head up. I don't want you feeling responsible for that. You know, we had a plan, and it worked. But Julian works for us for so many reasons. One, I like positive attitude, and Julian is a positive guy. I also, you know, I want to be around good people. I people that I like, people that I admire, and I admire Julian. I think he's a good rider. He always gives us his best. And, you know, it's not always just about the race. It's about the lead up to the race. Julian, a lot of people don't know this, but going through our period with Classic Empire, Julian would drive at 3 o'clock in the morning. He would drive from South Florida to Ocala to get on him. I mean, there's not a lot of riders that'll do that. And so Julian's a big part of our team. He also is, I'm a believer in that, you know, you got to let horses develop. And I don't like, for the most part, I don't mind being a little aggressive early. Norman and I battle over this quite often. I don't mind being a little bit, but I don't like to rush them off their feet. And that's kind of Julian. I mean, sometimes Julian, and I don't think so much anymore, but maybe before he was a little too passive. And I think Julian's got to become a little more aggressive early. You know, a lot of it, Mike, is where what racetrack you're riding at too, you know, and the surface, the racetrack. And, you know, we're trying, at least we're always trying to develop horses to get better as they get older. My saying, as I tell any rider, first-time starter, I'd rather be a closing fourth than a dying third.
Yeah.
And I think you build on that, and I think confidence. So about 15 years ago, I had a filly that cost, another trainer had her, I think she cost $1.5 million. And she came to me, and I think she had beat one horse in 3 starts. And I said to the owner, he said, what are you going to do? I said, what we're going to do is we're going to take her back to last. And I said, I don't care if she passes one horse. She's going to pass one horse. So we ran her, and she went back to last. She ended up passing 4 or 5 horses, and she ran good. And so I said to the owner, I said, well, that was a positive. She said, well, what's next? I said, we're going to do it again. We did it again the next time. She was third. And the next time she won. And then after that, I said to him, I think she'd be better to be a broodmare. And off she went. I thought we had accomplished all we could. But to me, that was a prime example of she was in this you know, this part where she wasn't passing any horses. She was running and stopping, and she got fine with that. I wanted her to be the other way. I wanted her to learn to run by those horses, you know, and give her some confidence that it turned out working. And so I do believe in that.
Yeah, it certainly worked well, and a lot of things that Mark Cassie has done over the years have worked very well, and that is a reason that he is in the Canadian Hall of Fame and has trained nearly 2,500 winners in that career. Mark, only a few minutes left before we have to wrap up the program. The hour has really flown by, and I wish we had another hour to visit because I could listen to your philosophies and stories all day long. You know, we started the show talking about your son, Norman, and he'll be going out on his own. He's already done so to an extent, saddling his first horse this past Wednesday. I asked him a couple of weeks ago when he joined us on this program about being in the same race as one of your horses when he is officially out on his own. And he said, you know, I'm really not looking forward to it. I'm not looking forward to having a horse, you know, beat one of Dad's horses. He said, I'm not sure he feels the same way, though. How about you?
You know, I think too much of that is being, you know, hey, look, we all like beating each other. It doesn't matter whether it's you're playing for nothing. One thing that I enjoy doing is I enjoy playing chess. And I play all the time with my other son, Joel, who is on the SWAT team. And I can tell you, he gets great pleasure out of beating me, and I get great pleasure out of beating him. Now, you know, I'm not going to go and sit there and say, oh, I can't wait to beat Norman. Of course not. I want Norman to win, you know. But yeah, it's a competition. We'll have fun with it. And you know, but it's not. So I think that's kind of gotten a little. I read or heard where he said something that dad's a little obsessed with that or something. No, not at all. Right now I want him to win. And believe me, I'm his biggest fan, and I'm trying to, you know, I know, given the horse, that Norman can train as good as any trainer there is out there. It's just right now, it's not easy. It's it's like building a team from scratch, and that's what he's going to have to do. And I have no doubt Norman's going to be very successful doing it.
Yeah, when people go back and listen to that program from 2 weeks ago, they're going to agree with you, Mark, because he was simply tremendous for the hour. You can do that on our website. It's horseracingradio.net. You can also check out the podcast of this program in just a little bit. As soon as we're done with the program here tonight, head on over there, horseracingradio.net, Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes, and listen to At Your Leisure. Mark, really appreciate the visit here tonight. As always, I can't thank you enough for all your time. You're very gracious every time I pick up the phone and call you. Thanks for being here. It was a really enjoyable hour, and go get it done. Good luck moving forward, my friend.
Well, I appreciate it, Mike. I always enjoy talking with you, and as you know, I love our sport, and I love talking about it. So you have a great evening yourself, and see you soon.
Thanks, Mark. Mark Cassie on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Class act, and somebody who really has things moving toward that ultimate goal of getting into the American Horse Racing Hall of Fame. It's going to happen, just a matter of time. Thanks for being with us here tonight. For our producer, Lee Della Pina, I'm Mike Pena. We are back with you next week with an all-new Trainer Talk. Thanks for listening.